the deal, it turns out not to be a decent car, they may come to us for help. If somebody's being evicted or if their landlord won't correct some problem, those are the types of things that people may come to us for assistance with.
How many incorrect phone calls do you get throughout the year? People thinking that you need the Legal Aid Justice Center means that you are the public defender's office.
We get quite a few, Rick. I mean, part of the problem is that one of the things people don't understand that's even more critical is that you have a right, a constitutional right to a public defender if you're facing a criminal charge that may have jail time. On the other hand, you don't have a right to a civil legal aid lawyer, and we're really only funded at about 20% of the documented need, which means that about 80% of the people who could and should be helped by us can't be helped because we don't have the resources.
All right. You know, I think we touched on that a little bit there, but the difference between not just the offices and the fact that you are not here for the most part doing criminal cases. You do a little bit with that, correct?
We do some juvenile justice and other things where kids who are in a treatment court, essentially, maybe being pushed out into an adult criminal court. And we touch on the fringes of it, primarily around children.
But for those of us who either weren't listening because we were touching other buttons on the board at the moment, but the main difference between civil and criminal cases, and why wouldn't you do both?
Just different systems that have evolved over time. And like I say, the U.S. Supreme Court in the late 60s, basically early 70s, created a body of law that says you have a right to a lawyer in a criminal case through a series of cases, first in serious felony cases, then in juvenile cases, and then in any case where there's a potential for jail time, the U.S. Supreme Court said you have a constitutional right to a lawyer. And so that system developed around that constitutional right. States were forced to fund some system of providing lawyers, but that didn't happen. That didn't happen with civil legal aid.
All right, we will be talking with Alex and Brenda from the Legal Aid Justice Center. Don't forget that at noon, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Perdue. That's the best of 80s and 90s alternative. Drew will bring you the roots of alternative music because you can't understand where we are now without first knowing where we've been. Take a trip back to the times gone by with Les Temps Perdue only on WNRN. All right, back with our guests, Alex Galata, Brenda Castaneda. You know, when we talk about the difference between civil and criminal rights, Brenda, can you tell me what are the rights that most often get ignored or broken, or, you know, what do you deal with at the center most frequently?
I represent a lot of tenants in housing cases, and I think the right to housing and the need for housing is a fundamental human right, and yet people are not guaranteed representation if they're getting evicted or if they have a problem with their landlord. So I think that's one big area that I see, and we handle a lot of landlord-tenant cases, but we turn many people away because we just don't have the resources to handle everybody who walks through the door. But in my experience, tenants that we are able to represent and go to court with or deal with the landlord have significantly better outcomes than the ones that end up going it alone without representation.
Alex, is that carryover? Is that for the center as a whole? The housing cases?
Well, and then Brenda does a huge amount of consumer protection work. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I do, yes. I also do consumer protection work. I've been in the past years concentrating a lot on predatory lending. So that would be considered just high interest loans. And it's payday loans, car title loans, open-ended credit loans that are high interest. So those loans can be as high as, 360% interest. There's not a lot of caps on them. I think the car title loans now can be 250% interest. It's huge high interest loans, that hit mostly low income people who can't afford them, who don't feel like they have other options, when they need cash quickly. And it really traps you in a cycle of taking out these loans and paying them off and then having to take out another loan to pay off the prior loan.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. If that's one of the programs that you see a lot of work on, we are talking with Brenda Castaneda, Civil Advocacy Program at the Legal Aid Justice Center. Alex Galata is the Executive Director. He's with us as well today. There's I don't know if it's new or not, but there's a program at the Legal Aid Justice Center, Bank On.
Yes, it's, well, we are working with Bank On, yes. And the idea is that since the General Assembly has decided to allow certain types of very, very high interest lending, that one way to attack that and to hopefully make it less necessary is to make sure that people in the local community have access to banks, have a relationship with a bank or a credit union where they can turn to for help instead of turning to a payday lender or a car title lender when they need, emergency cash, and to make sure that they're financially literate, that that they just have more resources available to them so that they can avoid those sorts of situations.
And if I could say, Rick, one of the things about that program, it's really not just legal aid. It's a whole coalition of local community partners, MACA, Love Inc., FAR, a bunch of different groups that have banded together to really try and improve the conditions, the financial conditions, of low-income families, and created this coalition. And we're actually in the process now of spinning it off. It'll be a separate nonprofit. Bank On Greater Charlottesville will be a separate little nonprofit. They've actually hired a full-time staff person. And part of what they're going to focus on is getting people into bank accounts and making sure that they get access to sort of fair banking products through the traditional banking structures.
All right, so let's talk about this for a minute, because as I do my homework for the show, I find this phrase somewhere in the Bank On initiative part of the Legal Aid Justice Center website. By the way, that's Justice for All. That's the number 4, justiceforall.org. Check it out to see what they do. You may find some information that can help you or a friend or a neighbor to look into the Legal Aid Justice Center. So, fair, reasonable, and just financial service products. For many people, I will say, should rephrase that, for some people in a fair market system, they're just doing what they should do, which is they offer a product that somebody needs to pay for. And if you can't borrow the money or, get the loan at a lower percentage, well, here we are to offer it to you. It's higher risk. We ask for a higher percentage paid back. Why do we need to have a program such as Bank On or other offerings from the center to help these people? This is not unfair. It's just the way the system works in a fair market economy.
It's not unfair. We're going to make it less unfair. And it's not unfair for us to use the resources that we have to say we could make it better and we could make it fairer, if you will, by creating these opportunities with traditional lenders. The reason poor people fell out with traditional lenders is in many ways because communities change. The banks weren't located necessarily in the same communities. Their branches weren't necessarily in the same communities. And the payday lenders, the car title lenders, they saw an opportunity. I can open up a shop in a poorer neighborhood and with little low overhead can lend at exorbitant rates and I can make money. And they will continue to exist, but if we can get low-income people connected with the local banks, it used to be you could go into your local bank if you needed to borrow $500, you could get a desk loan based on your character. And our community has changed and those things don't exist anymore. And so part of this is to help low-income people establish relationships with banks and bankers so that they can go in and actually have the kind of personal connection to those institutions that would allow them to get a personal loan.
The word poverty is used a lot throughout the research for the Legal Aid Justice Center. I think we're going to be coming back to that throughout the hour. But let's talk a minute about one of the highlights of the Legal Aid Justice Center, is what you consider access to justice. We're talking about access to loans, access to money for those who didn't have a bank in their neighborhood, et cetera. Let's talk about access to justice. One of the things that caught my attention is when you immediately sign on or check out the justiceforall.org website, that's the website for the Legal Aid Justice Center, is that there were 5 or 6 different languages in which you could check this out. It comes up in English, but you could also bring it up in Spanish, Korean, Chinese, French, or German. And so what that tells me is that a lot of work or concern is offered to immigrants. I'm assuming I'm not misreading that, but...
Yeah, well, there are a lot of immigrants, and poverty is becoming increasingly populated by people who don't speak English as a primary language. And I think many, many service providers that work in low-income communities realize we need to be able to at least deal with the fact that everyone doesn't speak English as a first language. There are lots of Spanish-speaking families, Latino families in our service area. There are also other families. The International Rescue Committee here in town brings in many families from Eastern Europe, from Africa, from other places where refugees come to the United States from. And so there's a huge need for services that aren't in English as a first language.
Brenda, what brought you to... the Legal Aid Justice Center?
Well, I went to law school here at UVA. I volunteered at Legal Aid while I was in law school, and I guess I just got hooked and never left. Alex never successfully got rid of me, so I stayed. I think I just have a sort of, I've always had a commitment to service and to helping those who maybe can't help themselves, and so it's a really good way for me to pursue that in my life and do something that I really love to do at the same time.
I say this because my father's an attorney, so I feel comfortable in saying that the stereotype of attorneys is not helping others unless they pay you well. Alex, you laugh, but you also have the look on your face about, well, there's some truth to that, even though maybe that's not fair to all.
There's some truth to that in every profession, in every endeavor in which human beings are involved. But I have to say, lawyers are incredibly generous with their time to organizations like the Legal Aid Justice Center.
I won't deny that. But the stereotype of that part is often overlooked.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, part of what I hope we can do is, you know, raise the stereotype, because, you know, the local bar here in Charlottesville, Albemarle, is incredibly generous and does, you know, thousands of hours of volunteer work every year. Part of the way we get part of our excess capacity comes from the fact that local lawyers come and take cases for us. We have clinics where there are housing clinics or unemployment insurance cases where lawyers come to our office, meet the clients, and basically if it's a meritorious case, they take it and they do it for that low-income client, and that helps us serve many more people. The local bar also just makes, I think of the local bar dues of the local bar association, something like a third or between a third and half of the total dues revenue from the local bar ends up getting donated back to Legal Aid in one form or another, which is, again, very, very generous. This is really a great community to be doing Legal Aid.
And one of the things that surprised me is, you know, again, we go back to the very beginning when the Legal Aid Justice Center is not the Public Defender's Office of Charlottesville, is that not only is it not just in Charlottesville, but you're throughout the state, correct, Brenda?
We have 4 offices. We're largely in Central Virginia, but we also have an office in Falls Church. So we have office in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and Falls Church.
And we have several statewide programs. Like, so our immigrant advocacy program is a statewide program. We have a Just Children program that has a statewide component to it, where we work on issues that impact children statewide. And they're important issues, very important issues. And they really make a difference in terms of changing the dynamic about how we interact with children. I was at a bar meeting this past week, and there was a speaker, this Dr. Franklin, who used to be the president of Morehead College, talked about how children, particularly young men of color, are basically being criminalized at younger and younger ages. They're being squeezed out of school. They're being pushed out of school. Their conduct's being criminalized. And that's consistent with this national movement that recognizes there's this school-to-prison pipeline. And I don't know if you've ever heard that phrase, but if you Google it, you'll find out that it's a huge sort of, if you will, movement in the anti-poverty world to try and stop the school-to-prison pipeline. And it just comes from, I think, a desire to try and exclude kids who exhibit bad behaviors, and that's probably not the best way to deal with those behaviors. And so that's important work, and we're doing it on a statewide basis.
It's Alex Collada. He's the executive director of the Legal Aid Justice Center. We also have Brenda Castaneda on. She focuses on the civil advocacy program, which we're going to get into a little more in just a moment.
91.9 WNRN Charlottesville.
89.9 WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg.
Listener supported independent music radio. WNRN.
And support for WNRN today coming from T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com.
Support for WNRN today comes from L. Oppelman, serving Lynchburg for 122 years. In addition to loans, L. Oppelman deals in jewelry, musical instruments, rifles, and handguns, game systems, TVs, cameras, and tools, with new inventory arriving every day. L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street, downtown Lynchburg.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much again for listening to WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Our guests, Brenda Castaneda and Alex Galata from the Legal Aid Justice Center. Brenda, you seem to focus on the civil advocacy program. So one of the things that I noticed is what seems to fall under the category of impact advocacy, I think I found on the website, was consumer law. I want to talk about that in the state of Virginia and have you tell me and listeners about that a little bit, because from a federal level, I'm aware of what that is. I know that there was Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was put into play in the last, during the Obama administration, but many would say was neutered, sort of the hopes of what it might do legislatively. Many of the powers were taken away. So can you talk about this on a state level, what the consumer law, how that works through the Legal Aid Justice Center, and how that might apply on a federal level, if at all?
I would say the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is in the process of passing new regulations. They passed new regulations on mortgages, and so I think some of the things that they'll be able to do will be helpful to consumers. But generally, consumer law has to do with buying and selling of goods and services or borrowing of money for personal use, for personal or household use rather than for business use. There's a number of federal laws that apply to things like how you disclose interest rates or how you...
So how do I get, how do I get screwed so that I need to come to the Legal Aid Justice Center?
Well, I think most of my clients aren't aware, the Fair Credit Reporting Act has been violated, but they come to me because they've gotten into some trouble. They've taken out a loan. They can't keep up with the interest. They've bought a car. It's turned out to be no good. They got involved in some house-to-house sale deal that ended up being not a good deal. Whatever they bought didn't work. That sort of thing. So they come in and say, I've got this problem. My car doesn't run. I've taken out this loan. I can't keep up with payments. Can you help me?
And then it turns out that there are these federal laws that have to do with interest disclosure. So part of the federal government's approach toward regulation has been many of the bad practices aren't regulated. It's that the interest rate disclosure is regulated, and what you can charge people and what you can charge them for and what you can't charge them for, what you have to classify as interest, what you don't classify as interest. And so there are really many technical violations that those are the only hooks, those are the only tools that are available to consumers to say this transaction was unfair. Most of the basic unfairness is not illegal. It's the failing to cross the T's and dot the I's, and that's where a legal aid lawyer can really make a difference for somebody who gets into a really bad deal and needs to be able to unwind it.
That's right, and that's one way that I think individuals really do need legal representation, because there is no way that a person on their own could sort of sort that out and figure out what laws have been violated. They really do need a lawyer in that case. There's a number of state laws, state protection, consumer protection laws as well that apply. There's the state version of the Uniform Commercial Code that has to do with buying and selling goods. There's the Virginia Consumer Protection Act, which makes a whole list of different misrepresentations or fraudulent practices illegal in consumer transactions. So we're able to leverage that when our clients come in and say, okay, this looks like something that falls under this violation and we can help you.
But at what point does the problem move from me as a consumer, me as an individual, and any mistakes that I might have made in planning, you know, and thinking about what car to purchase or whether or not to borrow this money from this person or sell this house? What point does it move from me solo to a wider scale where I can involve the Justice Center?
Well, I mean, we handle many individual cases, but if we see a pattern of bad behavior, if you will, if we see a pattern of illegal conduct, then the impact advocacy you were talking about is we're going to look for either a litigation strategy or a legislative or policy strategy to try and change that. So if we see the same type of violation again and again and again, it's not a good use of anyone's resources to just keep putting a Band-Aid on the same problem. And so the impact advocacy is where when we see a repeated violations of the same types of with the same types of conduct, then we're going to look for a bigger solution. That might be a class action lawsuit. It may be going to the General Assembly to try and get a law changed. It may be going to a state or federal regulatory board to try and get a regulation promulgated that might control or change that conduct. One of our lawyers, Claire Curry, is really working on this problem of the drugging of nursing home residents. Okay, antipsychotic drugs are being prescribed to people in nursing homes at an alarming rate, in contradiction of the black box warnings on these drugs. They shouldn't be used for the purpose that they're being used for, but they're expedient in that they keep people quiet. And sometimes that's a valuable thing to a nursing home. And so there's a big national movement now that, you know, Claire Curry, one of our lawyers, is at the front of to try and actually pass regulatory reforms that will limit that behavior and that will make sure that people that are in nursing homes aren't being prescribed drugs that they don't need.
If you want to call in with your question or comment for our guest today, Brenda Castaneda, Alex Galata from the Legal Aid Justice Center, 979-0919, or use the toll-free number at 877-967-6762. That's 877-WNRN-ROCKS if you need to call us outside the local area. 979-0919 from inside the area. You're talking about sort of a healthcare issue there with the antipsychotic drugs and the elderly living areas. Let's talk about one that's a little more local and specific, the Fluvanna Women's Prison. That's something that the Legal Aid Justice Center has taken on, correct?
Yes.
One of you tell more about that rather than me telling listeners.
Well, we have filed, last summer we filed a class action lawsuit against the Fluvanna Women's Prison for failing to provide adequate health care to the prisoners. it's something that I think we began to notice through our Institutionalized Persons Project, that we were getting complaints from women there that they weren't being treated when they were asked to be treated. They weren't being sent out to see specialists. They were worried about their health. They weren't able to get answers. Some of them had some pretty serious problems that they felt were not being addressed. And so over time, we began to meet with more prisoners there, and we decided that we needed to address this problem on a larger scale. So that court case is going forward. It's currently set for trial in October. And we're in the process of dealing with the Department of Corrections on that case, the local prison officials, and also Armor Healthcare, which is the private company that provides healthcare on contract to the prison.
And that's an interesting wrinkle there, Rick, in terms of that, you know, in this circumstance, the state doesn't actually provide the health care. They contract out with a private for-profit company that provides the health care. And that's a growing trend. And, you know, maybe it's part of the problem. We really don't know. We're looking at, you know, where or how this system broke down. But it does seem that the state didn't really feel like it had to provide the kind of oversight that we think they need to provide if they're going to try and do private contracts for services.
Tell me if this is accurate information or not, but when I read a little bit about this, is that the women prisoners, to get any medications that were allowed, had to stand outside between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. to get their medications? That was the only, is that true?
That's correct. There's a pill line. So if you have medications you have to take a certain number of times during the day, you have to go stand in the pill line to take the medications. And that has been done outside. It's been done in the cold. It's done very early in the morning. That's correct. We've had a number of women report that to us, and that's one of the allegations in our lawsuit.
Yeah, and maybe not always, but the point is that, for example, people go to UVA and have surgery performed and then don't get adequate post-operative care. These aren't, you know, the allegations that these women are making are not, in, you know, little insubstantial allegations. They're very serious allegations that in many ways their health is being jeopardized in such a way, you know, to be constitutionally actionable, the state has to be deliberately indifferent to an obvious health care issue, right?
When you say constitutionally, remind us what point you're bringing forth that this qualifies as a constitutional.
Right. So under the Constitution, prisoners have limited rights, and the primary right they have is to be free of cruel and unusual punishment, which is a pretty high standard. And what the Supreme Court has said when it comes to failing to provide medical care, it has to be deliberate indifference to an obvious medical need. And so, you know, these aren't minor things that we're complaining about. But you have people now, and, you know, part of it is just the demographics have changed. People used to be in prison for shorter periods of time. We're keeping people longer and longer and longer. We've effectively done away with parole, which is a way that we sometimes release people earlier. The more we keep people and the longer we keep people and the older we keep people, the more health issues they're going to have and the more we're going to have a system to adequately deal with those issues.
We talk about cruel and unusual punishment. The two that I remember from reading about this, there was a woman, and again, this goes back, this is Fluvanna, but it's run by a company called, or at least the healthcare, by Armor.
That's correct.
Correct, which has does business in multiple prisons throughout the state, at least, and maybe in other states as well. There was a woman in a Richmond prison who actually had her baby in the hallway, I believe, because she had gone forth and said, "I believe I'm in labor," and they said, "No, you're not." And then her claim was that she had the baby in the hallway. And then there's the woman from Fluvanna who had bleeding, and then once she was finally sent to UVA, it was turned out that she had abdominal cancer, stage 4 abdominal cancer. This was because they're being accused of premature death as well in some areas, correct? Or am I reading this from non-official statements outside of what the Legal Aid Justice Center can confirm?
Yeah, I think you're reading other things into beyond what's in our lawsuit. But you know, there's been a whole separate initiative that has been trying to limit the use of handcuffs and shackling, leg shackles, for women who are in labor, who are pregnant and in labor. And there actually has been some voluntary movement on the department's part in terms of some agreed upon changes to the rules that were brought about by some people on the Department of Corrections and a bunch of advocacy groups, including the Legal Aid Justice Center. And so, like, in terms of the shackling women during childbirth, which I think is a very archaic practice, I think we've made some headway, but there's just still a long way to go in many of these areas.
How do you, what's the conversation when somebody says to you, they're prisoners, why don't you worry more about the victims of the crimes that these people committed?
Yeah, I do worry about the victims, and I worry about our society as a whole. But the system is set up to punish people, but the punishment doesn't say you should die because you're not getting your high blood pressure medication. That wasn't the prison sentence. The prison sentence was 10 years in prison, and not you should die because we won't take care of your health conditions. And so I think that the balance is that these are all human beings. They have human rights. They have constitutional rights. And guess what? Almost all of them are going to be back in our communities next year or 10 years from now or 15 years from now. And I think we all have an interest in how they're treated while they're in prison, because they're going to be back in our communities.
But Brenda, some people are going to say, whether it's one or whether, you know, 1% or 100%, is that, well, you're misreading the Constitution. Fair and, you know, unusual punishment, that's not what this is. I disagree with what you're arguing about. You know, shackling them, that's what it is. You need to shackle them so that they, because they're prisoners. That doesn't prevent somebody from going into labor or getting them to the hospital when they do go into labor.
Well, it's not just looking at the Constitution itself, but the whole body of law that's happened since the Constitution was written, and the Supreme Court decisions that have happened since then that tell you, okay, how are we going to define what cruel and unusual punishment is? And what we're saying is, looking at that whole body of law, what's happening here violates that.
And I'm sure the defendant's position is it doesn't, and that's why there's a lawsuit. And so we were able to do discovery and to get a judge to look at the evidence and to say, does this constitute, you know, deliberate indifference to obvious medical needs, which is, you know, what the U.S. Supreme Court has said the standard is.
11:33 on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Talking with folks from the Legal Aid Justice Center, Alex Gawad is the executive director, Brenda Castaneda, civil advocacy program. You're welcome to call up with your question or comment, 979-0919 or 877-967-6762. You know, you touch on, or what I gathered out of some of these most recent comments, again, not just focusing on the Flavanna Women's Correctional Center, but it seems to me that much of what the Justice Center represents comes back to religion, politics, and law, and sort of mixing the three together in a very uncomfortable stew. Because you have people who believe that you did something wrong, go to prison, and don't let me see you again until you come back. You have others who say we need to treat those, you know, those in the lower, I can't even think of what the proper phrase would be, but those from a religious aspect who might say those who need us most are those who we must care for most. Do you find problems with what you do at the Justice Center because you have people battling you back? Or is it just difficult to do what you want to do because there's so much need?
I think it's primarily the need. There's a very, very small minority of people who sort of take issue with what we do and why we do it. But that would be a very, very small minority. And to be frank, I'm not sure I would characterize it as religion, but I do think that there is there is at least a humanist value system that says, you know, that how we treat other people matters, and that it makes a better society if we treat people with dignity and respect, and that the exception should be when people go over the line. And yes, there are people who go over the line, and there need to be consequences for their behaviors. But if you look at the school example, I think that's a good example. You know, in the 90s, we really went on this sort of get tough on crime rampage, if you will, where and maybe some of it was justified, and maybe actually some of it was appropriate, because maybe things were too soft or too easy. I don't know. But assuming some of it may have been appropriate or valuable, it very quickly spiraled out of control in many people's opinion, not just my opinion, and like social scientists' opinion and other people's opinion, such that there's now a fair body of evidence that says we went way too far, and that by criminalizing more and more behavior, we're just excluding people at a younger and younger level from sort of the normal processes of society, and that once we do exclude them like that, you know, we sort of treat them differently, we put them in another system, but they're going to join our system back again. And when they come back, we're all going to be the worse off for that, because we didn't actually treat them, deal with them. We didn't deal with their mental health problems. We didn't deal with the substance abuse problems or the other problems that may have been a contributing factor to their underlying behavior. And so I'm not an apologist. If somebody does something wrong, if they violate the law, then they need to take the consequences. But while they're serving those consequences, we should be figuring out, are there things we can do to help this individual come back, and then when they're done doing their time, be a productive member of society? And I think, actually, you know, Governor McDonnell has been sort of at the forefront of many sort of reentry efforts, and in trying to look at reentry, the restoration, you know, the bill that he proposed to restore the voting rights of felons. You know, I think that there's a broad bipartisan cross-section of people that understand that we would probably all be better off if we figured a better way to deal with people who engage in bad behaviors, whether it's kids in school or whether it's adults that violate the criminal law. We need to figure out a way to make that complex of relationships different, so when those people rejoin society, things are more positive.
11:38 here on the Wake Up Call, talking with Alex Scalata and Brenda Castaneda from the Legal Aid Justice Center. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about some of the policy work and the impact advocacy areas.
And support on WNRN comes from Price Hyundai on 29 North. From Hyundai, it's the new Veloster, 38 miles per gallon highway, standard BlueLink telematics with hands-free texting. The new Veloster, new thinking for the next generation of drivers. You can find out more at jimpricehyundai.com.
Hi, I'm Julia Wanch, health educator for the Thomas Jefferson Health District, inviting you to kick the smoking habit. The Charlottesville Free Clinic is starting its spring series of support group sessions of Quit Smoking Charlottesville. The sessions are open to the entire community in a friendly and supportive group setting. There will be a wide range of informative speakers and no advance registration needed. The sessions are free to all community residents and happen every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. beginning February 7th through late April. All sessions happen at the Charlottesville Albemarle Health Department on Rose Hill Drive. For more information, please visit us online at peoplefreeclinic.org. I'm Julia Wanch, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for listening to WNRN here on a beautiful Sunday. I'm going to let the guests get on it. All right, go to it, Alex.
So, whatever. I think it's dangerous ground to attribute bad motives to policymakers. I do think that the effect of many of these policies has had a disparate racial impact. And if you look at, you know, there's a whole discussion nationally about the disproportionate minority contact that that children in school have with the school discipline systems. And there are study after study that show that kids of color, black kids, Latino kids, more males, obviously, than females, that's what the data shows, are having their behavior criminalized. And I'm not going to get into the socio-political, whether that's, you know, because of them or us. The point is, it's an imbalance that we really need to work to try and close. And so there are real efforts around nationally to try and close the achievement gap between kids of color and other kids in terms of their performance and ability to stay in school and do well in school. And that's a positive model, and I think that's the thing we need to focus on. We need to focus on positive models to get from where we are to a better place, and I would rather not look back and say, oh, this is because of some evil motive.
All right. Thanks, David, for the call. If somebody else would like to call in, 979-0919, 877-WNRN Rocks. I don't think that many people would argue that David's conversation can certainly carry over into employment issues, whether or not you agree with his take on how that happens. What does the Legal Aid Justice Center do? I mean, you offered up earlier that people can call it because they have employment problems. What kind of specific employment problems are we just talking about, and how does the Justice Center assist?
Well, we assist in people who have been laid off or fired from their jobs and getting unemployment insurance through the state. And we also assist sometimes in employment discrimination cases and quite often in wage claims, people who come in and simply haven't been paid for the work that they did.
And we've had those have been big cases. Some of them have been national cases, and then they're very local cases. We had a string of workers right before Thanksgiving who were doing some painting in a local establishment as part of a construction project and ended up not being paid for several weeks' work. And there were, you know, I think between the 14 workers, it was probably $17,000 or $18,000. I don't remember the exact amount, but it was a chunk of money for these workers, and they weren't able to pay their rent and pay their bills because they just weren't paid. The subcontractor disappears. The people who own the business sometimes aren't paying close attention. And so we worked and were able to negotiate a deal to get those workers paid. But oftentimes we have to sue. Oftentimes we have businesses that don't pay the workers, think they can get away with not paying the workers. Those workers can be local domestic workers, but there are also many immigrant workers that also are cheated out of wages. And there is something there that relates back to David's question. It seems like, you know, people are more likely to cheat somebody who doesn't speak English or otherwise is an immigrant simply because they think they can get away with it, in my opinion.
One of the things that caught my attention was because originally when doing my homework, I thought this was the Legal Aid Justice Center. By the way, www.justiceforall, that's the number four, justiceforall.org. You talked about a larger case. There was something that had millions of dollars where, what was it called? Had to do with guys,
Immigrant tree planters.
Immigrant tree planters. Thank you for saving me from my inability to find the notes on my paper. But this also included, or it was based on something from Arkansas.
So we are in contact with other similar organizations in other states, and we recognized a pattern, you know, many years ago of folks that were coming. They would work in Arkansas and Georgia and come up the coast and work in North Carolina, come to Virginia, all planting trees as part of a seasonal approach to replanting trees and replanting forest lands. And these workers were not properly paid, and we're involved in a multi-year campaign with several other organizations to bring a regional class action that impacted where these workers worked. And there was a good bit of the work that was performed in Virginia, and that's how we ended up getting involved. And we ended up getting an $11 million judgment in one case, and we settled another case for about $2.75 million.
That's a lot of cash.
That's a lot of cash.
Is that punishment, or is that money? I mean, how does that money come in?
It's wages that were not paid. It's actual monies that were due and owing, or some of it was damages based on failing to comply with the contract, right? So the workers had a contract There's a law called the APA, the Agricultural Worker Protection Act, that says if you make statements in recruiting workers, those end up becoming a contract that the workers can enforce. So if you say, I'm going to pay you $8 an hour, and then you don't pay $8 an hour, the workers can enforce that as if it were a contract under this federal law. And so, but then they also, they need to be reimbursed for their travel costs, and so there was a claim related to the fact that they weren't reimbursed for their travel costs and a variety of other claims like that.
I find the word prey used a lot, and that's P-R-E-Y, people preying on others. How do you, at what point, again, I go back to economics, because many people talk about this, if you can't take care of yourself, if you make an incorrect decision, your fault, not their fault, not my fault. At what point does... Define prey in this, in the United States sort of economy.
I think Brenda should talk about some of her home rescue scam cases. Okay, those people were being preyed upon. Brenda,
right? So as we all know, there's been a mortgage foreclosure crisis going on the last decade or so, and many people, were just either through their own decisions or because they were sold something they didn't understand, got loans that were, they were just in over their head, couldn't afford to pay them. So there sort of became this whole secondary
industry
that sprang up around rescuing, foreclosure rescue. You're in foreclosure, call us, we'll help. And there's a lot of different permutations. There's the sort of lease buyback scam. And I had a case regarding that in federal court where these people who were really preying on homeowners who were in a really dire straits would come in and say, oh, well, just sign this paperwork and it's like a loan and just here's some papers to sign and we'll make sure that we'll take care of it and you'll pay us. And what the homeowners ended up doing was actually selling their house to these people and then entering into a lease. And then when they couldn't afford the lease, all of a sudden they get eviction papers and they're very confused because they thought, wait, I own this house. And so I would say that that's definitely predatory. That's not just normal free market capitalism economic activity. I mean, there's a lot of fraud involved in that, a lot of deception to the homeowners in terms of telling them what the papers really say or assuring them what would happen. Oh, don't worry, you'll have a chance to get the house back in your name. We're just temporarily taking it out of your name. There's other types of scams that just involve send us your paperwork. We'll look through it and see if there's, any errors or defenses against the bank. And so just don't pay your mortgage. Pay us. Send us $3,000. We'll take care of everything. And so the homeowners go ahead and do that. And then not only do they not pay their bank, but they've paid these other people $3,000. They might disappear into the night with it, and they haven't gotten any assistance out of it. So it's, sort of attacking people who are in a situation where they're under a lot of stress and very worried and really taking advantage of that.
And I would say, this is an area where, in fact, governmental regulation is valuable. Part of the reason some of those things happened is because there just wasn't adequate governmental regulation of some of these practices. And these were just complete frauds and scams. Like, these people would lie. They would make misrepresentations. They were in these corporations that were completely undercapitalized. And as soon as somebody started chasing after them, they would disappear into the night. One of the cases Brenda worked on, the principal that was involved ended up in prison in Maryland because, Maryland has some pretty strong consumer protections and actually put this guy in jail for what he was doing. But he victimized a bunch of people in Virginia. And, had it not been for Brenda working, a few people that she was able to help that we were able to track down, but many, many others, I'm sure, were ripped off. And they looked for people that had equity in their houses, right? And so they looked for people who had money to steal. Older people, oftentimes, the elderly and other folks, and then they would do their research, and then they would swoop in and say, oh, we'll help you out, we'll fix this for you, and then it would be one of these scams, and next thing you'd know, you're getting evicted from your own house.
Right, and touching on what we were talking about before with impact advocacy and how we look at and see, okay, this is a problem, and what can we do on a larger scale instead of just helping each homeowner as they happen to come into us? Several years ago, we worked with Housing Opportunities Made Equal out of Richmond to actually add a section to the Virginia Consumer Protection Act that specifically outlaws some of these types of foreclosure rescue scams. So that was one way we were able to say, this is a problem. We need to have a specific law against it, and adding it to that statute, which allows for a lot of civil remedies for consumers who get involved in that sort of thing.
So there's success for the group in the sense of you find the person committing the fraud. What happens to the people who have actually been victimized? Are you able in any way to get them their home back or their money back? Or is the overall success being that the criminal was put in jail?
Well, we usually don't get too involved in criminal prosecution. That case was sort of unusual, but I think, you know, our idea is to keep the person in their home. If somebody comes into me, that's what I'm going to try to help them with, is let's keep you in your home. And the particular case I had, not only did we keep the lady in our home, but we got a lot of the damages back because some of the people that she got involved with had insurance, and we were able to not only keep her there, get the home back in her name, but also to get her her damages satisfied from all the stress and other problems that came up because of basically having the title to her home stolen from her.
And we do look for ways like, oh, can we help a broader range of people? That would be like a class action lawsuit, right? That's when you might bring a class action lawsuit if you have an individual practice that's horrendous, it's clearly illegal, but you have to look at the pros and cons. You don't bring a class action lawsuit against a little undercapitalized shell corporation, because why invest all of those resources in trying to track that down? Because there's nowhere to go with it. And that's why, like Brenda said, we would have not even for the individual, we would have gotten nothing out of that case, even though it was clearly illegal behavior, except for the fact that there were some required bonds that Brenda, you know, insurance essentially that Brenda was able to go after that would protect against that.
11:54 here on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Fascinating conversation. Brenda Castaneda and Alex Galata from the Legal Aid Justice Center. Let me take a moment and remind you that today's program, and also supported by the Jefferson Theater, presenting Robert Earl Keane with Andrea Davidson on Friday, February 1st. What separates Robert Earl from other songwriters is that he matches his lyrical literature with irresistible melodies, resulting in music that attracts thinkers and dancers alike. Tickets for the February 1st show, jeffersontheater.com. All right, the last few minutes with our guest today. Talk for a minute, the local Human Rights Commission. How does the Legal Aid Justice Center mix in together with the goals and purpose of that group?
I think the idea of a local Human Rights Commission grew out of the city's dialogue on race discussions. I think that's where the genesis of that idea came from. And Legal Aid, several of our staff people were involved in that. We weren't officially involved in the dialogue on race. But the idea behind the commission will be to look at issues of race and discrimination in our community, possibly at an individual enforcement level and in a bigger systemic level. And clearly our low-income clients, you know, have an interest in that conversation. We see a number of people every year that have employment and some housing discrimination complaints, and there really aren't the federal resources that are available are very under-resourced, and you can't really get much help with many of those things unless they're really, really egregious. And so I think one of the ideas is to create a local commission. In my opinion, it really needs to have enforcement powers, and I think that's one of the things that City Council is grappling with. But if it has real enforcement powers where people can be held accountable, I think we can get these conversations and these issues resolved. One of the problems right now is that is that you have somebody who feels like they've been discriminated against, and that doesn't get resolved for years. You know, it just never gets a solution, and nobody's ever said yes or no, or there's never really a determination that's made. And I think that it would behoove us all if we could, you know, have a quick, efficient process where the people who are at odds with each other can be brought together and have a conversation about what occurred and figure out if there's a way to make amends, we may all be better off. And I think that this has the potential to do that, and I think it's a very exciting thing. And I would urge people to contact City Council and support it and ask that there be an enforcement mechanism that's part of that.
11:57 here on the Wake Up Call. Brenda Castaneda, Civil Advocacy Program at the Legal Aid Justice Center. Alex Galata, the Executive Director. We touched on it earlier, the Voting Rights Restoration Bill that has gone through the Virginia legislature. And Alex, I believe you made a comment to the fact that that's a nonpartisan issue to make that work. But my memory is that the House, strong Republican side, didn't even let it out of the partial committee, the subcommittee, while the Senate has recently passed it through, but the focus being on the fact that while it is bipartisan, that all the nays came from one party. So do you envision this going forward and actually happening?
In my opinion, it's good policy, and we should do it. I'm not sure that there'll be the votes in the House to make it happen. But it was proposed by the governor and by the lieutenant governor and by I think the attorney general, and then I think it was supported by a pretty big coalition from both sides of the aisle in the Senate. So I'm not sure why a small minority of people in the House should be the undoing of it, but that may be the way the process works.
Brenda, just a minute left. Do you see many former felons coming through the program, through the advocacy programs that you highlight?
I do. I see a whole cross-section of people. I mean, it may be people who've been, you know, in contact with the law, who've been in prison. It may be people who are just hardworking family people with kids. It may be people who are disabled. I mean, I would say it's a whole spectrum of people. And I can't say that that's, you know, the main part of my clientele. I mean, it's everybody. It's anybody. It's any one of us, really. Anybody who loses their job, just gets a major health problem. I mean, anybody can sort of be in that position and need our help.
It's amazing that the number of people we often talk about, the percentage of people in poverty, and then people often forget how many, many more, multiple times, people who qualify as near poverty because you have few savings, because you have no equity, because it only takes one or two lost paychecks before you can't pay your bills. And it's nice to know that the Legal Aid Justice Center is there, whether needed today or needed tomorrow. Thank you both for coming on the air.
Thank you.
Alex Galata from the Executive Director at the Legal Aid Justice Center, and Brenda Castaneda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Les Temps-Perdue up next. Have a great day.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Angie Cruz. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.